Mary Boleyn is a kind little blonde, who is said to have been passed all around the French court before coming home to this one, scattering goodwill, her frowning little sister trotting always at her heels. "Of course, I have followed the direction of His Majesty's eye," the Cardinal says. He nods to himself. "Are they now close? Does the Queen know? Or can't you say?" He nods. The Cardinal sighs. "Catherine is a saint. Still, if I were a saint and a queen, perhaps I would feel I could take no harm from Mary Boleyn. Presents, eh? What sort? Not lavish, you say. I am sorry for her, then. She should seize her advantage while it lasts. It's not that our king has so many adventures, though they do say... They say that when His Majesty was young, not yet king, it was Boleyn's wife who relieved him of his virgin state.
Elizabeth Boleyn? He's not often surprised.
This one's mother? The same. Perhaps the king lacks imagination in that way. Not that I ever believed it. If we were at the other side, you know..." He gestures in the direction of Dover. "We wouldn't even try to keep track of the women. My friend, King Francois, they do say he once oozed up to the lady he'd been with the night before, gave her a formal kiss of the hand, asked her name, and wished they might be better friends." He bobs his head, liking the success of his story. "But Mary won't cause difficulties. She's an easy armful. The king could do worse."
"But a family will want to get something out of it. What did they get before?"
"The chance to make themselves useful."
Wolsey breaks off and makes a note. He can imagine its content. What Boleyn can have, if he asks nicely. The Cardinal looks up.
"So should I have been in my interview with Sir Thomas, how should I put it, a more douce?"
"I don't think my lord could have been sweeter. Witness his face when he left us. The picture of soothed gratification."
"Thomas, from now on, any London gossip..." He touches the damask cloth. "Bring it right here to me. Don't trouble about the source. Let the trouble be mine, and I promise never to assault you. Truly."
"It is forgotten."
"I doubt that. Not if you carry the lesson all these years."
The Cardinal sits back. He considers.
"At least she is married. Mary Boleyn, he means. So if she whelps, he can acknowledge it or not, as he pleases. He has a boy from John Blount's daughter, and he won't want too many."
"Too large a royal nursery can be encumbering to a king. The example of history and of other nations shows that the mothers fight for status and try to get their brats induced somehow into the line of succession. The son Henry acknowledges is known as Henry Fitzroy. He's a handsome blonde child made in the king's own image. His father has created him Duke of Somerset and Duke of Richmond. He's not yet 10 years old, and the senior nobleman in England. Queen Catherine, whose boys have all died, takes it patiently. That is to say, she suffers." When he leaves the Cardinal, he's miserably angry. When he thinks back to his earlier life, that boy half dead on the cobbles in Putney, he feels no tenderness for him, just a faint impatience. Why doesn't he get up? For his later self, still prone to getting into fights, or at least being in the place where a fight might occur, he feels something like contempt, washed with a queasy anxiety. That was the way of the world. A knife in the dark. A movement on the edge of vision, a series of warnings which have worked themselves into flesh. He has given the Cardinal a shock, which is not his job. His job, as he has defined it at this time, is to feed the Cardinal information and soothe his temper and understand him and embellish his jokes. What went wrong was an accident of timing only. If the Cardinal had not moved so fast, If he had not been so edgy, not knowing how he could signal to him to be less despotic to Berlin. The trouble with England, he thinks, is that it's so poor in gesture. We shall have to develop a hand signal for back off, our prince is fucking this man's daughter. He is surprised that the Italians have not done it, though perhaps they have, and he just never caught on. In the year 1529, my Lord Cardinal newly disgraced, he will think back to that evening. He's at Isha. It is the lightless, fireless night when the great man has gone to his possibly damp bed. And there is only George Cavendish to keep his spirits alive. What happened next, he asked George, with Harry Percy and Anne Boleyn. He knew the story only in the Cardinal's chilly and dismissive rendition, but George said, I shall tell you how it was. Now, stand up, Master Cromwell. He does it. A little to the left. Now, which would you like to be, my Lord Cardinal or the young heir? Oh, I see. Is it a play? You be the Cardinal. I don't feel equal to it. Cavendish adjusts his position, turning him imperceptibly from the window, where night and bare trees are their audience. His gaze rests on the heir, as if he were seeing the past, shadowy bodies moving in this lightless room. Can you look troubled? George asks, as if he were brooding upon mutinous speech, and yet dare not speak. No, not like that. You are youthful, gangling, your head drooping, you are blushing. Cavendish sighs. I do believe you never blushed in your life, Master Cromwell. Look. Cavendish sets his hands gently on his upper arms. Let us change roles. Sit here. You be the Cardinal. At once he sees Cavendish transformed. George twitches, he fumbles, he all but weeps. He becomes the quaking Harry Percy, a young man in love.
Why should I not match with her? He cries. Though she be but a simple maid.
Simple? He says, maid. George glares at him. The Cardinal never said that. Well, not at the time, I agree.
Now, I'm Harry Percy again. Though she be but a simple maid, her father a mere knight, yet her lineage is good.
She's some sort of cousin of the king's, isn't she?
Some sort of cousin?
Cavendish again breaks up his role indignant.
My Lord Cardinal would have their descent unfolded before him, all drawn up by the heralds.
So what shall I do?
Just pretend. Now, her forebears are not without merit, young Percy argues, but the stronger, the boy argues, the more my Lord Cardinal waxes into a temper. The boy says, we have made a contract of matrimony, which is as good as a true marriage.
Does he? I mean, did he?
Yes, that was the sense of it. Good as a true marriage.
And what did my Lord Cardinal do there?
He said, good God, boy, what are you telling me? If you have involved yourself in any such false proceeding, the king must hear of it. I shall send for your father, and between us, we will contrive to annul this folly of yours.
And Harry Percy said,
not much. He hung his head.
I wonder the girl had any respect for him.
Well, she didn't. She liked his title.
I see.
So then his father came down from the north. Will you be the earl, or will you be the boy?
The boy. I know how to do it now. He jumps to his feet and imitates penitence. It seems they had a long talk in a long gallery, the Earl and the Cardinal. Then they had a glass of wine. Something strong, it must have been. The Earl stamped the length of the gallery, then sat down, Cavendish said, on a bench where the waiting boys used to rest between orders. He called his heir to stand before him and took him apart in front of the servants.
Sir, says Cavendish, thou hast always been a proud, presumptuous, disdainful, and very unthrift waster.
So that was a good start, wasn't it?
I like, he says, the way you remember the exact words. Did you write them down at the time? Or do you use some license? Cavendish looks sly. No one exceeds your own powers of memory, he says. My Lord Cardinal asks for an accounting of something or other, and you have all the figures at your fingertips.
Perhaps I invent them.
Oh, I don't think so.
Cavendish is shocked.
You couldn't do that for long.
It is a method of remembering. I learned it in Italy.
There are people in this household and elsewhere who would give much to know the whole of what you learned in Italy.
He nods. Of course they would. But now, where were we? Harry Percy, who is as good as married, you say, to Lady Anne Boleyn, is standing before his father, and the father says...
that if he comes into the title, he would be the death of his noble house. He would be the last Earl of Northumberland there ever was. And, praise be to God, he says, I have more choice of boys. And he stamped off, and the boy was left crying. He had his heart set on Lady Anne, but the Cardinal married him to Mary Talbot, and now they're as miserable as dawn on Ash Wednesday. And the Lady Anne said, well, we all laughed at the time, she said that if she could work my Lord Cardinal any displeasure, she would do it. Can you think how we laughed? Some sallow chit, forgive me, a knight's daughter, to menace my Lord Cardinal. Her nose out of joint because she could not have an earl. But we could not know how she would rise and rise.
He smiles.
So tell me, Cavendish says, what did we do wrong? I'll tell you, all along we were misled. The Cardinal, young Harry Percy, his father, you, me. Because when the King said, Mistress Anne is not to marry into Northumberland, I think the King had his eye cast on her all that long time ago.
While he was close with Mary,
he was thinking about Sister Anne.
Yes, yes. I wonder, he says, how it can be that, though all these people think they know the King's pleasure, the King finds himself at every turn impeded. At every turn thwarted, maddened and baffled. The Lady Anne, whom he has chosen to amuse him, while the old wife is cast off and the new wife brought in, refuses to accommodate him at all. How can she refuse? Nobody knows. Cavendish looks downcast because they have not continued the play.
You must be tired, he says.
No, I'm just thinking. How has my Lord Cardinal missed the trick, he wanted to say. But that is not a respectful way to speak of a cardinal. He looks up. Go on. What happened next?
In May 1527, feeling embattled and bad-tempered, the cardinal opens a court of inquiry at York Place to look into the validity of the king's marriage. It's a secret court. The queen is not required to appear or even be represented. She's not even supposed to know, but all Europe knows. It is Henry who is ordered to appear and produce the dispensation that allowed him to marry his brother's widow. He does so, and is confident that the court will find the document defective in some way. Wolsey is prepared to say that the marriage is open to doubt, but he does not know, he tells Henry, what the legatine court can do for him beyond this preparatory step, since Catherine, surely, is bound to appeal to Rome. 6 times, to the world's knowledge, Catherine and the king have lived in hope of an heir. I remember the winter child, Wolsey says. I suppose, Thomas, you would not be back in England then. The queen was taken unexpectedly with pains, and the prince was born early, just at the turn of the year, when he was less than an hour old. I held him in my arms, the sleet falling outside the windows, the chamber alive with firelight, the dark coming down by 3 o'clock, and the tracks of birds and beasts covered that night by the snow, every mark of the old world wiped out, and all our pain abolished. We called him the New Year's Prince. We said he would be the richest, the most beautiful, the most devoted. The whole of London was lit up in celebration. He breathed 52 days, and I counted every one of them. I think that if he had lived, our king might have been, I do not say a better king, for that could hardly be, but a more contented Christian. The next child was a boy who died within an hour. In the year 1516, a daughter was born, the Princess Mary, small but vigorous. The year following, the Queen miscarried a male child. Another small princess lived only a few days. Her name would have been Elizabeth, after the king's own mother. Sometimes, says the cardinal, the king speaks of his mother, Elizabeth Plantagenet, and tears stand in his eyes. She was, you know, a lady of great beauty and calm, so meek under the misfortunes God sent her. She and the old king were blessed with many children, and some of them died. But, says the king, my brother Arthur was born to my mother and father within a year of their marriage, and followed in not too long a time by another goodly son, which was me. So why have I been left after 20 years with one frail daughter whom any vagrant wind may destroy? By now they are, this long-married couple, dragged down by the bewildered consciousness of sin. Perhaps, some people say, it will be a kindness to set them free. I doubt Catherine will think so, the cardinal says. If the Queen has a sin laid on her conscience, believe me, she will shrive it, if it takes the next 20 years. What have I done? Henry demands of the cardinal. What have I done? What has she done? What have we done together? There is no answer the cardinal can make. Even though his heart bleeds for his most benevolent prince, there is no answer he can make, and he detects something not entirely sincere in the question. He thinks, though he will not say so, except in a small room alone with his man of business, that no rational man could worship a god so simply vengeful, and he believes the king is a rational man. Look at the examples before us, he says. Dean Colet, that great scholar. Now, he was one of 22 children, and the only one to live past infancy. Some would suggest that to invite such attrition from above, Sir Henry Colet and his wife must have been monsters of iniquity, infamous through Christendom. But in fact, Sir Henry was Lord Mayor of London, twice, and made a very large fortune, so in no way was he slighted by the Almighty, I would say, but rather received every mark of divine favour. It's not the hand of God kills our children. It's disease and hunger and war, rat bites and bad air, and the miasma from plague pits. It's bad harvests like the harvest this year and last year. It's careless nurses. He says to Wolsey, what age is the Queen now? She'll be 42, I suppose. And the King says she can have no more children. My mother was 52 when I was born. The cardinal stares at him. Are you sure? He says. And then he laughs, a merry, easy laugh that makes you think it's good to be a prince of the church. Well, about that anyway. Over 50. They were hazy about these things in the Cromwell family. And did she survive the ordeal? She did. I congratulate both of you. But don't tell people, will you? The living result of the Queen's labours is the diminutive Mary, not really a whole princess, perhaps 2/3 of one. He has seen her when he has been at court with the Cardinal, and thought she was about the size of his daughter Anne, who is 2 or 3 years younger. Anne Cromwell is a tough little girl. She could eat a princess for breakfast. Like St. Paul's God, she is no respecter of persons, and her eyes, small and steady as her father's, fall coldly on those who cross her. The family joke is, what London will be like when our Anne becomes Lord Mayor. Mary Tudor is a pale, clever doll with fox-coloured hair, who speaks with more gravity than the average bishop. She was barely 10 years old when her father sent her to Ludlow to hold court as Princess of Wales. It was where Catherine had been taken as a bride, where her husband Arthur died, when she herself almost died in that year's epidemic, and lay bereft, weakened and forgotten, till the old king's wife paid out of her private purse to have her brought back to London, day by painful day in a litter. Catherine had hidden, she hides so much, any grief at the parting with her daughter. She herself is daughter of a reigning queen. Why should Mary not rule England? She had taken it as a sign that the king was content. But now she knows different. As soon as the secret hearing is convened, Catherine's stored-up grievances come pouring out. According to her, the whole business is the fault of the cardinal. "I told you," Wolsey said. "I told you it would be. Look for the hand of the king in it. Look for the will of the king." No, she cannot do that, for the king in her eyes is immaculate. Ever since Wolsey rose in the king's service, the queen claims, he's been working to push her out of her rightful place as Henry's confidant and adviser. "He has used every means he can," she says, "to drive me from the king's side, so that I know nothing of his projects, so that he, the cardinal, should have the direction of all. He has prevented my meetings with the ambassador of Spain. He's put spies in my household. My women are all spies for him." The cardinal says wearily, "I have never favoured the French, nor the emperor neither. I have favoured peace. I have not stopped her seeing the Spanish ambassador, only made the quite reasonable request that she should not see him alone, so that I might have some check on what insinuations and lies he presents to her. The ladies of her household are English gentlewomen who have a right to wait upon their queen. After almost 30 years in England, would she have nothing but Spaniards? As for driving her from the king's side, how could I do that? For years his conversation was, 'The queen must see this,' and 'Catherine would like to hear of this. We must go to her straight away.' There never was a lady who knew better her husband's needs. She knows them, for the first time. She doesn't want to comply with them. Is a woman bound to wifely obedience when the result will be to turn her out of the estate of wife? He, Cromwell, admires Catherine. He likes to see her moving about the royal palaces, as wide as she is high, stitched into gowns so bristling with gemstones that they look as if they are designed less for beauty than to withstand blows from a sword. Her auburn hair is faded and streaked with grey, tucked back under her gable hood like the modest wings of a city sparrow. Under her gowns she wears the habit of a Franciscan nun. Try always, Wolsey says, to find out what people wear under their clothes. At an earlier stage in life, this would have surprised him. He had thought that under their clothes, people wore their skin. There are many precedents, the cardinal says, that can help the king in his current concerns. King Louis XII was allowed to set aside his first wife. Nearer home, his own sister Margaret, who had first married the King of Scotland, divorced her second husband and remarried. And the king's great friend Charles Brandon, who is now married to his younger sister Mary, had an earlier alliance put aside in circumstances that hardly bear inquiry. But set against that, the fact that the church is not in the business of breaking up established marriages or bastardizing children. If the dispensation was technically defective, or in any other way defective, why can it not be mended with a new one? So Pope Clement may think, Wolsey says. When he says this, the king shouts. He can shrug that off, the shouting. One grows accustomed, and he watches how the cardinal behaves as the storm breaks over his head. Half smiling, civil, regretful, he waits for the calm that succeeds it. But Wolsey is becoming uneasy, waiting for Boleyn's daughter. Not the easy armful, but the younger girl, the flat-chested one, to drop her coy negotiations and please the king. If she would do this, the king would take an easier view of life and talk less about his conscience. After all, how could he, in the middle of an amour? But some people suggest that she is bargaining with the king. Some say that she wants to be the new wife, which is laughable, Wolsey says. But then the king is infatuated, so perhaps he doesn't demur, not to her face. He has drawn the Cardinal's attention to the emerald ring Lady Anne now wears, and has told him the provenance and the price. The Cardinal looked shocked. After the Harry Percy debacle, the Cardinal had got Anne sent down to her family house at Hever, but she had insinuated herself back to court somehow, among the Queen's ladies, and now he never knows where she'll be, and whether Henry will disappear from his grasp because he's chasing her across country. He thinks of calling in her father, Sir Thomas, and telling him off again, but even without mentioning the old rumour about Henry and Lady Boleyn, how can you explain to a man that as his first daughter was a whore, so his second one should be too, insinuating that it's some sort of family business he puts them into? "Boleyn is not rich," he says. "I'd get him in. Cost it out for him. The credit side, the debit side."
"Ah, yes," the Cardinal says, "but you are the master of practical solutions, whereas I, as a churchman, have to be careful not actively to recommend that my monarch embark on a studied course of adultery."
He moves the quills around on his desk, shuffles some papers.
"Thomas, if you are ever... how shall I put it?"
He cannot imagine what the Cardinal might say next.
"If you are ever close to the king, if you should find, perhaps, after I'm gone..."
It's not easy to speak of non-existence, even if you've already commissioned your tomb. Wolsey cannot imagine a world without Wolsey.
"Ah, well, you know I would prefer you to his service, and never hold you back, but the difficulty is..."
Putney, he means. It is the stark fact. And since he's not a churchman, there are no ecclesiastical titles to soften it, as they have softened the stark fact of Ipswich.
"I wonder," Wolsey says, "would you have patience with our sovereign lord? When it is midnight and he's up drinking and giggling with Brandon, or singing and the day's paper's not yet signed, and when you press him he says, 'I'm for my bed now, we're hunting tomorrow.' If your chance comes to serve, you will have to take him as he is, a pleasure-loving prince. And he will have to take you as you are, which is rather like one of those square-shaped fighting dogs that low men tow about on ropes. Not that you are without a fitful charm, Tom."
The idea that he or anyone else might come to have Wolsey's hold over the king is about as likely as Anne Cromwell becoming Lord Mayor. But he doesn't altogether discount it. One has heard of Jeanne d'Arc, and it doesn't have to end in flames. He goes home and tells Liz about the fighting dogs. She also thinks it strikingly apt. He doesn't tell her about the fitful charm, in case it's something only the Cardinal can see. The Court of Inquiry is just about to break up, leaving the matter for further advisement, when the news comes from Rome that the Emperor's Spanish and German troops, who have not been paid for months, have run wild through the Holy City, paying themselves, plundering the treasuries and stoning the artworks. Dressed satirically in stolen vestments, they've raped the wives and virgins of Rome. They've tumbled to the ground statues and nuns and smashed their heads on the pavements. A common soldier has stolen the head of the lance that opened the side of Christ and has attached it to the shaft of his own murderous weapon. His comrades have torn up antique tombs and tipped out the human dust to blow away in the wind. The Tiber brims with fresh bodies, the stabbed and the strangled bobbing against the shore. The most grievous news is that the Pope is taken prisoner. As the young Emperor Charles is nominally in charge of these troops, and presumably will assert his authority and take advantage of the situation, King Henry's matrimonial cause is set back. Charles is the nephew of Queen Catherine, and while he is in the Emperor's hands, Pope Clement is not likely to look favourably on any appeals passed up from the legate in England. Thomas More says that the imperial troops, for their enjoyment, are roasting live babies on spits. "Oh, he would," says Thomas Cromwell. "Listen, soldiers don't do that. They're too busy carrying away everything they can turn into ready money." Under his clothes, it is well known, Moore wears a jerkin of horsehair. He beats himself with a small scourge, of the type used by some religious orders. What lodges in his mind, Thomas Cromwell's,